Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And SouthsideBroadcasting.podbean.com. All the way down to the island of Jersey, all the way back from the island of Jersey, and launching the latest edition of Graham Harper's Sound and Director's Vision. Graham, welcome once again to your show.
Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. I'm really pleased to be here.
So, Bergerac, was this the first off-mainland series or story you'd ever directed? The first time I actually had left England as such and gone across the water, at least, to Jersey?
Yes. I went abroad, gosh. And what was wonderful about getting Bergerac was it was my taste as a director. Well, my second taste, because I had just directed previous year a Doctor Who story, The Caves of Androzani, which was my first attempt at doing action-adventure. And here was a lovely chance to do another action-adventure story on a Jim Bergerac story on the island of Jersey. And the script I got, written by Tessa Coleman, who lives on the island, or in the island, as they call it then, she wrote this piece, and it was really exciting. I mean, every 2 minutes there was a bomb going off or people firing at each other. There was a piece of action so many times throughout the whole episode. It was a real task and one I really relished. I really enjoyed doing it. And the crew and the cast were fabulous. It was just such a lot of fun to do. In other hands and another time, that might have been very, very difficult to do. But everybody actually wanted to get on with it and enjoy doing it. And also, everybody knew Tessa Coleman, who was someone, she was a journalist and she wrote for a local magazine. So she was always on the set interviewing people, etc., you know, for a magazine, I think. So she was quite well known and very, very well liked. So it was a pleasure to be working on her script, as it were. I loved doing it. I had Warren Clark in it as playing the main villain in the story with Lynn Farley. There was just such a lot of wonderful people. Maurice Reeves was in it. That was a second chance for me to work with him. And it was just glorious. But part of the reason I wanted to talk about all the programmes we're going to talk about today was my involvement And collaboration with each composer for each of the series I worked on, because each story, obviously each episode, not episode, but each series had their own, allocated their own composer. And so I found it a joy, and sometimes tricky, because you had to get on the same wavelength as they were, and they'd been doing the series much longer than I had, for example. For example, in Bergerac, I mean, Ray Russell was the composer, not of the theme tune, but he was the composer for all the incidental music, for all the episodes that were being done, certainly when I was working on it. And that was smashing, because he's a rock musician who has turned composer, and this was obviously in the 80s, and he was really interesting, and very open to all sorts of ideas. And one of the things I discovered I did virtually in every job I did where I was working with a composer, I always had an opportunity or found an opportunity to add something I felt was missing in the music, a sound effect or a musical instrument giving a little something, which reflected maybe the mood I was trying to get for that particular scene, the particular piece of music was going to back, or that I thought would be haunting as a memory somewhere deep in the background of the music, that would just be reflective of another moment or whatever. And I noticed that I do that, although I didn't go in going, oh, I'm going to get my hands in here, because I'm not a musician. I wouldn't know how to do it. But I knew there were certain things missing. And Ray was the first person I think I had a chance to add something. For example, in the Bergerac story, Sins of the Father, there's a scene with a Vicaro, I think his name, the character played by Morris Reeves, a CIA sort of character, a shady character who's observing and watching the goings-ons of a film set in Jersey. I'm making a film. Bergerac was making it was the story of a making of a war film, in which the main character is a tricky, naughty kind of man. And there was this guy following him, played by Morris Reeves. And I just said to Ray, when I heard this haunting theme that he created for a dark moment with this guy at a window watching something out of the window at night, and I just said to him, do you know what, Ray? This piece of music you created, it just needs a bit of depth to it, reflecting this character, this American character. And I said, what if you had a haunting locomotive howling through the night skyline, as it were, in the distance on an American plane somewhere? So you've got that woo woo of a haunting locomotive going, which places him absolutely from America, this guy. And Ray did it. He actually included not the sound of a train, but he had a musical sound within the theme that was a haunting locomotive. It was really, really interesting.
Of course, Bergerac known for John Nettles in the lead from that point of view. How did you find working with John? Because no pun intended, he occasionally has got a reputation of being a little bit precious at times. Was he okay? Or do you not want to talk about it?
Do you know, I didn't know that, and I had no problems with John at all. We got on very well. Which was lucky for me, obviously. I had worked with John on Bergerac before, but I was an assistant director to Martin Campbell, would you believe, who did one of his first directing jobs was a Bergerac, and I happened to be his first assistant. So I got to know John a bit by being a first. When I came on board as a director, he was really, really smashing to me, knowing it was my first film job. It's the first time I'd worked on film, really, as a director. And he knew that, and he knew I was very nervous and shy of everybody. I was really hoping that I could persuade people to go with my dreams, and would my dreams work? And they were fabulous. They really did help me actually make a fantastic action piece of work. So I got on very well with him and all the cast. They all wanted to make this smashing.
And if memory serves, was this the first time you'd actually employed Philip Hurdwood, one of our regular collaborators and connections here, or was that for a later programme?
That was a later one. I think this was in 1985. In 1986, Jonathan Orwin, the producer, asked me back to do another story.
And be the memory man.
And it was the memory man. And Philip,
we
was,
can remember, Graham. Sorry.
Yes. It's wonderful. I'm glad you said, because I didn't. And Philip definitely was playing one of the henchmen to a lord who was on the run. It was a Lord Luke kind of story. Someone had done something naughty and he was on the run being helped by two Hooray Henry kind of henchmen.
And Bergerac, I suppose one of these days, I mean, as most of these things are, will be released on DVD and people can access it if it hasn't already been. So it's important to actually to work through that. Of course, this is the beginning of a period in the 80s where prolific is your middle name in many ways, Graham, because right in the middle of Bergerac, of course, we come to this next piece of music. You talked about, obviously, the rock musician world of Ray Russell, that side of things. I think it was Ray Russell you mentioned. Here's another sort of classic case where, with the Moody Blues, of course, renowned for a variety of epic productions. And this latest composition that we're about to hear came on the back of, obviously, his huge success with Forever Autumn. And, of course, Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds. We're referring, of course, to Justin Haywood, that man from Birmingham.
Yeah. Yes. I never met Justin, which is a shame, because I'd love to have talked to him about War of the Worlds and also the Moody Blues, because they were a very, very famous rock band. So Justin was asked to write the theme tune, which I think didn't go down very well, if I remember rightly, as a theme tune. I mean, as a piece of music, it's smashing. I don't think it got highly recommended by anybody, which is a shame, because it's a very nice piece of music, very good piece of music, written by Justin Haywood. And Tony Visconti, who I think was certainly the producer that produced Justin Haywood's work, The Moody Blues. But Tony Visconti and Justin did all the incidental music for Star Cops. But I worked, as did Chris Baker, the other director on it. I mean, we were two directors on the series. We both worked with Tony Visconti as the composer, but I know that Justin Haywood was somewhere in the background collaborating with him. But the person I met was Tony Visconti. And again, that was a fabulous collaboration again, because they would naturally get the episode when it was finished in the edit suite. And then they would observe the episode. You would then have a meeting, probably in a sound studio somewhere, and go through the piece, stopping and starting, saying, I'd love something here, I'd love it to finish somewhere there. And you'd leave the beginning and the end, maybe it'd be a few frames earlier than you wanted, or maybe it would start a few frames later. You left that discretion to them, because they, as artists, would feel where the music might start to come in, might start earlier as a thought line in the background or underneath. David Calder, who played the main character, thinking about something, and the music may start there and then develop into the next scene that he's going to play in. So it was interesting then to go back and hear all the music that was composed, set to the pictures before it was done as a pilot rather than with the full orchestra or full in full instrumentation, and you would agree or not, because sometimes you go, oh, this doesn't feel right, I'm sorry to say, maybe it should be more uplifting, or maybe it should be more moody and creepy or whatever, and they would take that piece out and rewrite that and do something else, and then probably send a copy to you to listen to. And you'd have to watch it lucid against the pictures on a recorder of some sort and decide whether that was the improvement that was required. But very interesting. And I cannot tell you how exciting it is to go into a recording studio with music that you feel has been composed for you, because you've been the person that's collaborated with the composer, not the producer or the artist. And so really they're pleasing you with the music. And and to go and listen to it being recorded and adding your little bits and pieces to that is a fabulous experience. I cannot tell you, everybody should have that moment, because you can feel the music thumping into your body because you're in the studio with the musicians. It's really, really interesting, very exciting.
Might it have been at the time that the reason people perhaps weren't or didn't warm to Justin Hayward's thing that we're about to hear, as I say, it won't be easy, was because they were expecting something like Roger Limb was producing, and more of an electronic, more of a kind of perceived futuristic aspect, whereas what you got was kind of classic orchestral aspect with obviously some futurism within that. And it was just a case of you were confounding expectations.
Yes, I don't know. I actually liked it, to be honest. And I mean, it also was new and it was interesting as opposed to becoming the norm. The problem that we had, which was the same for Doctor Who and why Roger, I thought, just raised the bar, was by that time, by the mid-70s and then the early 80s, we had Star Wars and Raiders. So you had these big John Williams kind of orchestral chases going on that you had, the television programmes had to compete with. So I think Tony Visconti and Justin Hayward were trying to go for that kind of feel, the orchestral feel, which Kubrick had obviously tried all the time and was very successful at. But maybe it was too romantic, I don't know.
And you're listening to Graham Harper's Sound and Director's Vision. And a significant moment has been reached, Graham, because this is the time where, as a director, you move to the other side. You move to the opposition. You go to commercial television. And you hope that, all being well, you will have that silver lining, as indeed we're about to hear from Boone. So talk to us about Boone, Michael Elphick. And, of course, I mean, was it a case of, look, I'm a director, I'll go wherever my agent recommends me or suggests, or wherever the deals are actually based? Or did you actually feel as though somehow stepping over that bridge? Because it used to be a big thing, certainly probably until maybe the late 80s, early 90s, for people to actually, certainly for the talent and the kind of the entertaining thing, to actually shift from BBC to ITV or vice versa. Big move. Did you get that sense at all as a director?
Yes, you're right. It was, I mean, a lot of directors in that period did work for both BBC and ITV, but very rarely. It did happen, but you were either a BBC kind of director or you were an ITV product. I think it was quite hard for new directors to break out from either BBC or ITV to the other channel. There were three channels by then, BBC One, BBC Two had been going a few years now, and ITV. But there were many television companies that provided material for ITV, like Granada, Yorkshire Television, Southern TV, etc., etc.
Tyne Tees.
And even
in 1982, Channel 4 had actually opened up as well. So it had just to take its
line. So you had four channels, but you had quite a few independent television companies to try and get work in. So it wasn't just four major stations. There were quite a lot of companies you could try and get work in. And finally, my agent managed to get me a job on Boone. But that was also because the producer of Star Cops, Evgeny Gridnev, left the BBC because he was freelance by this stage. And his first job for ITV, would you believe, was Boone.
Yorkshire Television, I believe.
Or
is it Central?
Central
it
Television.
It was Central, fair enough.
Yeah, it was Central, which were the old ATV company, renamed Central. They were in Birmingham, but by this time in 89, they'd moved. They wanted to move to new studios in Nottingham. And Boone, although it was a Birmingham-based story, it was actually now being made, full series, I think, was now being made on tape, videotape rather than film, from Nottingham studios, new studios there. I don't know if we were the first drama to be done from the new studios, but we were certainly early. It was early drama for that studio. And Boone had to, the first thing that the executive producer asked was that, because the series had been made on film before, now it's being transferred to completely on videotape, the transferring to videotape should, on the eye, should look as pleasing as possible. If you can remember, in those days, I mean, now it's totally different, but in those days, videotape was very pristine and electronic cameras were very sharp and clear. You had to work on the lenses to make it look anything remotely like the mystique of film, i.e. the focal length. If you could use the long lens of the lenses much more and pull the cameras back and tighten up the lenses, you could get the background slightly out of focus, defocused, like it can be on film. And it becomes more mystical and more interesting. And you hone in onto what is sharp, which is the foreground. Or maybe you want to do it the other way. You want to have lots of blurred foreground and the sharpness is in the depth. I was the first director on Boone to transfer to, or show it being transferred to video, and make that as easy on the eye as possible. So I worked with the operator in great discussions, and the DOP, on how we would achieve that. And I said, could we, instead of using turret lenses, or zoom lenses there were in those days, that I would like a whole set of prime lenses for each of the electronic cameras. And then we would be getting closer to how film technique is using lenses, which we did. But unfortunately, so we did make it look really, really interesting. But unfortunately, the cost of having prime lenses on every block of filming was very expensive. And so unfortunately, it was agreed that we would dump all that and go back to long, the zoom lenses of video cameras. But I managed to persuade the operator to always use the long lensing side of it so that we could really make it more interesting, more filmic. It was a nice, interesting exercise. I loved Boone. Michael Elphick was a dream to work with. As was David Dacre and Neil Morrissey, a very young Neil Morrissey playing Rocky. A lot of fun. My problem with the show was the music. It's not that I didn't like it. It was just that if judging by the opening title, you can see that it's country and western. It's about men on motorbikes posting letters or delivering things or whatever. So it was kind of sort of, they were horsemen, they were like cowboys. So it was country and western. Dean Friedman's music was very country and western, very very lighthearted.
As indeed is Jim Diamond's, which is what many people might remember as the original theme from Boone, I should say. Hi Ho Silver.
Save me from this nightmare. Hi-ho,
So the other thing, of course, I liked about Boone in many ways, Graham, was you got a lot of take on the titles, because The Relief of Matty King, I think, was the title of the first one, I suppose, the Relief of Matty King. Do Not Forsake Me, of course, that's another one you did. Don't Buy For Me, Argentina, got to be one of my favourites. And, of course, we have Undercover and Bad Pennies. So nice little theme working through that. And, of course, you worked on it for five episodes, as say those five mentions. So presumably you got to know Central and Nottingham quite well in those days.
I did. I liked Nottingham. It was Robin Hood country. It was absolutely brilliant. I did enjoy it. And the countryside around Nottingham is beautiful. So I advise everyone, as soon as you can, get yourself up there and have a day out, because it's a lovely county.
You're close right by about Lincoln, of course, as well.
Yes, you could. Or if you go to Lincoln, you've then got that lovely walk up the hill to the cathedral. Beautiful. What a lovely, the lanes. I don't know what they're called. Is it the lanes?
Steep Hill.
Steep,
and indeed the University of Lincoln there as well, which of course knows you, which is all good.
And that steep hill is steep, but do it, because it's a lovely rope walk, very beautiful buildings. The problem with the music was that Boone also had some really, really mystical, creepy, strange stories, as well as the light-hearted comedy romps. Generally light-hearted comedy romps, the music really worked. But for some of the more sinister pieces, you needed something just a bit more flexible. You needed something more creepy and strange. And I didn't think always the music lent itself. So I tried on one particular episode to find some mood music that would be more psycho, more creepy and sinister. But the producer said, get rid of it. Don't want it. We'll never be offered to work again. Put back the incidental music that we've got a library of, and make it work. So we did, but I took the music out and then tried to find just little incidental things to lay underneath the country and western, just to give a hint of sinister, but not too sinister, so it will frighten the life out of everybody and keep it in the tone of the programme. So I learned a lesson there. I did as I was told, and I don't know whether they were right or wrong.
And sandwiched, of course, in between your work for Central Television and Boone, I think we do have a Yorkshire Television entry here, four episodes of Stay Lucky, which was connected within that whole field with, of course, Dennis Waterman. We're going to actually have a listen now to the theme from that, which I believe it's the composer who we've already spoken about before, Ray Ellis, who's actually behind this.
Ray Russell.
Just as well as your show, Graham, I'd be at loss otherwise. So Stay Lucky, talk to us about that, Graham, in terms of the sequence. I think much beloved. I think if memory serves, it used to get a screening at 9 p.m. on a Friday evening, if I recall.
Yes, and it was, again, it's the first time I'd worked with Dennis Waterman.
Your lookalike, of course.
Well, or I'm his lookalike, poor man. What was interesting is, as kids, we vied for the same jobs as young child actors. Invariably, I didn't get them, but every now and then I got one that he didn't get. But I was probably the unluckier one. He's good. He's a good actor. And there was a period very early on in his career, when he did a series called Sextet for the BBC, which was seven plays using seven actors all playing, like in repertory, different kinds of roles, maybe the most unlikely roles sometimes, as if it was weekly rep in the theatre. And he, each week, he was brilliant. They all were. But it was really interesting to see why Dennis was the lucky one to get all the parts where I didn't quite get them, because he was a terrific actor.
Let's face it, Dennis Waterman might have done great things, but he was never in the position of being Moonface in Noddy in Thailand. So that's something he can never take away from you, Graham. So that's very important.
Yes, I don't think he'll ever want to.
He was certainly at this stage coming out of his time, obviously, within Minder, which he was very popular for. Obviously, he'd also transcended his work with John Thorne in The Sweeney. So he'd moved on from those two sort of things. This was very much his series, I felt. I mean, the line was that basically this was his chance to shine. I mean, in Minder and The Sweeney, he was obviously a star, but he was kind of the co-star as opposed to one of the main leads.
Yes. This was his show with Jan Francis. Again, a really nice double act. They got on very well. They had huge respect for each other and also listened to each other and enjoyed making and working together. And I loved it. I thought it was a lovely show to work on. And I really got on with Dennis. I really had a good time with both of them. I thought it was smashing. And again, we had fabulous guest artists turning up each week, which was a lot of fun to do. And they also enjoyed his company and her company because they were very generous. They knew, like all good actors who are the stars, that they're only as good as who comes in and supports them and works with them. And I think a lot of actors came and really enjoyed that freedom and also that generosity of actors. So it was a delightful series to work on. Again, the production team were fabulous. It was lovely operators, great crews and DOPs, and good stories. So they were interesting to do. And Dennis and Jan seemed to really enjoy not just working with each other, but being there and doing the series. They enjoyed it. They knew they had a success and that they were doing very well in the ratings. So it was a lovely thing to work on.
We've just been listening to the wonderful sound of Jim Parker's introduction or theme to the House of Elliot. This time, Evgeny Grinev, who we mentioned a couple of times before, obviously with reference to Boone and Space Cops, Star Cops, I should say, as opposed to Space Cops, easily confused.
Yes.
Space Cops. No, Star Cops.
Star Cops.
Thank you. But here we are, effectively, with Evgeny as a writer for The House of Elliot, to give it its full title, another drama, and you're brought in for the episode which starts, it's now the spring of 1924, and the Elliot sisters are still basking in the glow of the successful launch of their collection, and you're back with the BBC for a Saturday night drama.
Yes. Again, what a fabulous show to work on. I mean, I'm not sure I'm the right person to work on a show that's all about fashion. I am. But I'm not sure many people would have considered me at that stage. But Evgeny I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name of the producer. It's gone right in my brain.
Jeremy Gwilt, I think. Jeremy Gwilt.
Jeremy Gwilt.
Gwilt, indeed.
How do we get out of that?
Using the magic of IMDb, Graham. That's what I say. Jeremy Gwilt.
No.
Wilt.
Oh, dear. It's dreadful. My memory. Jeremy was the producer, and it was Jeremy who employed me. But, of course, Evgeny was his script development, and he storylined with Jeremy the whole of The House of Elliot. So it was his baby. So he was sort of, in that sense, with Jeremy, the showrunners.
We should mention, of course, as well, Eileen Atkins and Jean Marsh, who are obviously very much connected with the whole sort of running of the series as well, presumably.
It was their idea, the whole thing. I think eventually, because of work commitments, they had to hand the whole storyline in for the second series. I didn't work on the first series. I worked on the second and third. And I think they'd handed over the storylining to Jeremy and Evgeny, and they obviously were executive producers in that sense. They had the last say on the scripts, etc., and left it to them. But it was their baby, obviously. They created it. I had the marvellous opportunity of doing in two episodes which were shot in Paris. So to shoot Paris in 1992-93 period, as if it was 1924, was quite challenging, because anybody that's been to Paris will know it's like London. It is full on traffic jams. It's chaotic in terms of the amount of people, etc., that are on the streets. And they certainly don't look as though they're wearing fashion of 1924s. So there's a sequence, for example, we did, which was one of the girls, I think it was Rose, was walking across Pont Royal, which is a beautiful bridge with beautiful golden light bulbs, beacons, etc., in the heart of Paris. And so we got permission to close it off from 6 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock in the morning. So we had 2 hours to do a couple of short sequences on that bridge, with our own extras who were all dressed in the correct clothes of the period. And we had the odd cars going across, which were 1924s, Hispano Suizas, I think they were called. Big, beautiful, big, very expensive, classic saloons going across to give the kind of feel for the period. Ah, it was such a joy to sort of have empty streets and redress them to look 1920s with the fashion and the essays, the walking up and down the streets in that period to recreate 1920s. It was such a lot of fun. Tricky to do and very, very joyful. I hope you all know that I really like directing. I loved making television programmes and I enjoyed this challenge enormously. It was fabulous. And then to do montages of Paris, all the sights with beautiful music. Oh, wow. It was wonderful. Again, we come to the meeting of the composer, the collaboration. And Jim Parker, who was the composer for all of the incidental music, including obviously the opening and closing titles, was a lovely person to work with. He had such a lot of experience in jazz, orchestral, classical, little quartets. He had such a lot of expertise. So sometimes you knew you needed orchestral sounds, and sometimes you just needed a little jazz quartet of the 1920s. So the music he created always had that lovely feel of Gershwin, I suppose, the 20s and 30s kind of feel. Lovely big orchestral, beautiful, gentle, inoffensive, lovely music. Again, music that you can add to and collaborate with the feeling that you wanted.
And we're concluding this particular episode of Sound and Director's Vision, Graham Harper's Sound and Director's Vision, with, of course, Jim Parker's little sequence from The Wedding of House of Elliot.